Welcome back to the Land Podcast. Hope you guys are having a great week. Things are crazy, so I'm a little bit late, but nonetheless, I have a couple quick announcements before we get into this week's episode. First one being, if you are interested in bidding on a top-tier whitetail farm, look no further than the auction I have going on April 10th, Rock Island County, Illinois, near the Iowa border. Some really awesome tracks. Track 2 is very interesting. It butts up to an eagle refuge that allows no human foot traffic from October 1 to April 1. Really exceptional genetics in this area based off of the past pictures and talking with the sellers. This is a fourth generation farm, so we have four tracks available. If you are a diehard deer hunter, I'd look at combining track 1 and 2 together, or I'd look at track 4 very closely. And if you're in that Rock Island County area, think about building a house. Track 3 is a perfect fit. It butts up to a forest preserve where you're not going to have any neighbors on one side of your property. So check that out. I'll be out of the farm April 6th from 1 to 5 o'clock. If you want to come check out the farm, more than happy to show it to you. I'll be there for 4 hours. Come check out this awesome piece, and it'll be going live for bidding April 10th. You don't want to miss it. April 10th, 1 p.m. So be sure to reach out if you have any questions regarding that. Also, this episode is with the guys over at Hoxie Seed, and I love what they're doing. They harvest and grow a lot of their own seed. They're very just thoughtful with what they're selling and putting in the ground. They have a lot of really great options. If you're putting in CRP or Equip, give them a call, shop them, learn a little bit more what they have going on and how it's pertinent to what you're planning, and mention that the Land Podcast sent you. And also, if you want to save 10% off on the Prairie Farm website, you can use the code HOFER, just my last name, H-O-F-E-R. They have a whitetail deer habitat mix. They have pheasant habitat mixes, quail habitat. They have native turf lawn. They have all sorts of different options. If you want to start a little backyard prairie, they have seeds for that too. So take advantage of that. I'm really excited to plant the whitetail deer habitat mix. There is a bunch of different varieties, and we're actually been talking about in the part 2 version of this podcast, so I'm not going to spoil that anymore. But hope you guys enjoyed this episode. This is a great, great conversation for anyone learning more about native habitat, why is it important, and what you can do as a landowner or a aspiring landowner. Let's get into this week's episode. Here we go. Nicholas Kent, welcome to Land Podcast. How's it going?
We're doing good. Great, man. Thanks for being patient with us today. It's a little crazy on the farm right before we got on the podcast.
Yeah, well, that's okay. And I would be lying if I said I've never been a few minutes late to a podcast either, because stuff comes up. You guys are operators, and I would say your business is very seasonal and probably very, very busy times and probably just busy times. But before we get into, we have a lot of really exciting things to talk about here today. I think some timely things and some things that, as landowners or aspiring landowners, I think that there's a lot of things that you guys can discuss and share and some thoughts that really don't get talking, spoke about a lot in this arena. So I'm really excited about that. But before we get into that, go ahead and do a little introduction so people know who you are.
Nicholas, you get to go first, man.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I guess I was at Hoxie first. So we should probably start with my dad. I mean, he's not on the podcast, but Carol Hoxbergen, he founded Hoxie Native Seeds and pays Kent and I to host our own podcast separately, but I run the operations. So I make sure that our website's up and running and our and everyone who orders seed gets their seed. And in a small business, everyone does everything. So Kent and I joke, what we do for a living is we hang out and we get paid. And that's what we do. So yeah. I grew up on the prairie farm. I kind of joke with people that I'm probably the only Filipino man of all time to live on a prairie farm and work on a prairie farm. So, I don't know. I'm not used to introduce. I'm used to having to introduce other people. This is kind of weird.
Yeah. No, that's really cool. Growing up on a prairie farm it's probably one of those things when you're a kid, you probably don't really appreciate it when you're younger, cause it was just what you knew. And then as you've gotten older, you're like, man, I'm pretty lucky to grow up on a farm and do prairie, cause it's so unique.
Yeah. I didn't realize how unique it was, and I just did not appreciate the thousands of hours I spent hoeing weeds. And I probably should have, like, Kent's out there and having the time of his life, and 12-year-old Nicholas was like over it. I tell people that working on the farm was never, I'm so social, it wasn't working on the farm that would be hard for me. It was if I was ever doing it alone for long periods of time. But then I left and I moved to Dallas for college first and then finished in Northern California. And I was like, whoa, farms are awesome. I was so privileged to grow up on a farm. I have this thing inside of me. I can't handle traffic. Like, it hits buttons I don't even know that I have. It's because I never dealt with traffic. It took you 50 minutes to go 50 miles. And you know, you're in California, and 50 minutes to go like 2.5 miles sometimes, literally. So,
yeah. That's really awesome. And then Kent, you're kind of your recurring guest here, which is,
that's right.
I gotta indicate that for everyone to go back and listen to what we discussed. You're previously formerly a teacher, and then I'll let you take it from there.
Yeah. So I used to be a biology teacher, and you know, I had a nice run with that. I did that for 8 years, and 7 of those 8 years were pretty good. And then year 8 did me in, and you know, kind of like what Nicholas was talking about there, how I enjoy getting out into the fields and doing all the labor that's required to keep 50. Well, now I think it's going to be 53 species of native plants, you know, clean enough to be harvested and have a healthy growing season. I love doing that because for my last 3 years of teaching, I didn't have windows, and I needed to be in a place where I didn't need windows. And so I get a lot of outside time now, and we're coming into a transitional season right now, which is interesting. Just how, like you said at the beginning, Jake, where work is so seasonal for us, and it really is, you know. I think that's one of the privileges, like when Nick talks about how fortunate people are to live on a farm, you are so in tune with what's just naturally happening, you know, like you literally work by the seasons. Mm-hmm. And so, I don't know, what would you say, Nick? I think I start heading out into the fields in April, kind of mid April, and doing some weeding, and some of our earlier species like, Ohio and prairie spiderwort. Yeah. And then, you know, I still do a little bit of seed cleaning then. And then by May, you know, it's pretty much helping with planting and burning, and then full on, you know, weeding in the fields through the summer. And then come, you know, in the summer and into fall, we're harvesting. You know, we basically start harvesting, and I think the Ohio and prairie spiderwort we did, I want to say June 15th last year.
And it was early. It's important to note that when people hear farming, they kind of think like clean cut seasons, but when you're farming 50 species, those seasons bleed into each other,
right?
So all summer and all fall, you know, you're doing planting and you're harvesting and you're weeding and you're cleaning, and it's just you get it done when you can.
But I mean, in general, you know, you can break it down to like once we get through late October, well, really mid October, we're pretty much done harvesting. Mm-hmm. And at that point it's officially seed cleaning. And so that's what we're kind of wrapping up right now, is I'm doing, you know, kind of those species that, yeah, it'd be really nice to have if we could have them for this spring, but otherwise we'll get them for the fall. And then
AKA the species that Kent did not want to clean earlier this season.
There's some that are just miserable to clean, but and then also helping Nick with putting mixes together. I just actually started that today. So getting all our mixes ready for all of our customers that are going to be doing some plantings, you know, this spring, early summer time frame. And so we're in another transitional season. But yeah, you know, I love working at Hoxie. Like it's truly a thing I got to pinch myself every day that I get to do this. You know, I told my mom once when I was on the phone with her, I was like, Mom, if I wasn't doing this stuff like for a job, I'd probably be doing it for a hobby. You know what I mean? It's just the best, it's what I like to do. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Which even with the biology background, I could imagine you probably have a higher level of appreciation on a lot of this stuff. But one thing that I find when we were talking to the Iowa Deer Classic, I got the snippet of the story of how Hoxie got started. And I think it's an awesome story. So I want to hear how it originally kind of came to fruition and kind of by accident.
Yeah. Nicholas, you're the family member there, so you should probably get us started on that.
Neither of us were there. Kent was maybe 5 years old or something, but
I'm not that old, man.
Like 1978 or something. Oh, whatever. Look, so dad kind of took over the family farm, and credit to Grandpa Harold, he really was hands off. He let dad farm how he wanted, and look around today, and that's not as common. Maybe Grandpa was just tired, you know, he just didn't want to deal with it, but he really let dad farm how he wanted, and he farmed for a while. And even in the 80s, he was doing no till. People were, I mean, basically his neighbors bullied him for it and were pretty mean to him about it. They were like, this is not how you do it. What are you doing? He was kind of against the grain the whole time. And then early 80s, getting into the mid 80s, he had a good friend who would ask him, hey, do you got a place to hunt? I got a good hunting dog. I got a good bird dog. Where can I go hunt? You got anything? And everyone called my dad Hoxie. His first name's Carol. He was just a pretty big BA guy in high school. And one guy teased him one time about having a girl name. And I think he beat that kid up. If I remember the story correctly. And so they all were too afraid to call him Carol. So they all called him Hoxie. They started calling him Hoxie. And so they call him Hoxie. And Hoxie, you got a place to hunt. You got any place to hunt? And he didn't have anything. But he noticed that pheasants were leaving his cornfields to go across the road where one of the two places in the county that the DOT had decided, hey, we're going to practice growing some natives. And it was like big blue stem and Indian grass. You know, it wasn't much of a mix, but there was something there. And
the pheasants there, they were basically foraging out there in the cornfields during the day and mm-hmm. be in the evening time when they'd go back to, I guess, what do you say for a ground nester? I get, they don't really roost in trees like turkeys or anything, mm-hmm. but kind of going back to roost timeline of the evening, they'd go to that prairie grass Nick was talking about.
Yeah. And so he noticed that, and that kind of got him thinking. And we were hitting the middle of the 80s where you couldn't make money on corn. In fact, one year, the only money dad made on corn was the government stored him, or paid him to store it in his bins and in his sheds. They would just dump corn on the ground in sheds because they had nowhere to put it. It had totally plummeted. And that's when people were losing farms left and right. You couldn't make money on pigs or cattle. You couldn't make money on corn or beans. So what are people doing? Well, he had the idea, well, I'll try and grow some Indian grass, some natives. And he tried, and he got some out of Nebraska, and he sucked at it for a few years, you know, just like everyone who's trying. He had some help from some family members and from a local veterinarian who was real curious about the stuff. And after a while, he kind of got it growing. Well, one year he burns down this Indian grass field, which, you know, burning is an integral part of prairie stands. And he accidentally catches, I think it was 4 or 5 cedar trees that were all in a row on fire. I mean, 60-foot flames, huge flames. And he's thinking, ah, crap. Well, that summer, native grasses that hadn't shown for decades popped up. And so you're talking about big blue stem. I believe he said Virginia wild rye, big blue stem, Indian grass, switchgrass, little blue stem. Yep.
Wow. And they were under those cedar trees. So they've been shaded by those cedar trees for decades.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And they'd been dormant. I mean, for decades, you're talking about these plants just by the roots survived under there, shaded out by the trees. And he had a few plants, and he took the few seeds off of those few plants. And he went from that to a place, a 500 square foot size field. And then from that 500 square foot, he'd hand collect and he'd beat those seeds to get them to germinate. And then he'd plant them, and then he'd maybe get a quarter acre. And then, you know, I think our big blue stem, we might have 40 something acres of it today, and little blue stem at our peak maybe had 30 acres, and that one kind of fluctuates, and Indian grass we have over 30 acres. So he really, I mean, painstakingly by hand, tons of mistakes in there, kind of grew this tiny, tiny little area under cedar trees to hundreds of acres in prairie. And that really started it. And maybe 20 years ago, he really started going after flowers as well. He wanted to learn how to grow flowers, and he's done a heck of a job, and some family members, including myself, have stepped in. And then Kent came begging for a job. He didn't have any windows. So he's basically family at this point. And yeah, that's kind of where we're at.
That's so fascinating. And so when this goes live the week before, it was actually a story of a father and son. And it's the father telling the story of them going bankrupt during the 80s in Iowa and having to sell the farm and how they lost money and the storms and everything else. So it's actually an interesting parallel of, you know, he had to go get a job in town. And then the interesting parallel of you burn down a tree on accident, and all of a sudden you have the a new business born. Which is so crazy. And that's during hard times, it creates some form of ingenuity, which is obviously really crappy during that time frame. But
it's worth also noting that Dad, he didn't have a family he had to support at the time, and he just worked all day and all night. So he had a couple of jobs, and then he would farm in the evening, or when he could fit it in the cracks. And he says he doesn't think he would have held onto the farm if he had a family to support. He doesn't think he would have been able to, because he said, I would just go to the store and get cans of beans or bags of beans, and I boil them, I just eat those.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're soft. We're so soft now. No, that's really cool. So that gives a backstory on kind of the business. Cause I think when people go to buy seed, they don't realize that someone has to sort through it and clean the seed. Someone has to grow it. It's we're so far removed from pull out your credit card and punch in the information. It shows up to your door. But there's a lot that goes into getting the seed ready for you to plant whatever you want. So I think that's really interesting. But I think as people are maybe shopping right now and looking at some different things, is all seed created equal? I mean, if I go on Amazon or I go on Walmart or I go to whatever bag with a big deer on it, is it all created equal?
No. Man. I got a great little story on that for you, Jake. That comes out of the Deer Classic. So we had, we spoke with just tons and tons of people. It was great. I love doing the trade shows. If you do them right, they can be energizing, because you're meeting with people that care about a lot of the same things you do. But we had this one family stop by, and they were real nice and everything. And they were just like flat out honest. They were like, man, we have this area. We just built a house a few years ago. We reworked the yard and everything. And we just bought this mix of seed, and we got it on Amazon, and we have no idea where it came from. And now we got all these weird weeds and none of the native plants. It's like, yeah, that's kind of how we end up with like Ceresia lespidiza or some other, horrible.
There's an amaranth scare.
Some terrible invasive plant. But yeah, that's you're exactly right with what you're getting at, Jake. Is no, not all seed mixes are created equal, and we even have to, because obviously we can only produce so much seed every year, and we get more clients than we can even, we sell out of our stuff. And we even though we grow over 50 species, a true remnant virgin prairie could have, hundreds of species growing in it. So there's many other prairie species than we can even grow. So we have to bring in some seed from time to time from other producers that we work with. And we have to be super careful that we don't accidentally, mix their genotype with our genotype, and our, we don't want their seed ending up out in our production fields, because we believe we have such a high quality product that, we don't want a chance, blending a genetic line from somewhere else and jeopardizing that. And so, yeah, we pay a ton of attention to that. And it's been an issue in other places, not just in this, kind of funny story of ending up with these strange weeds from who knows where in these people's yards. We were just at the North American Prairie Conference this last summer, which, if you have listeners that are really interested in prairie and prairie conservation and ecology, I believe that conference runs pretty much every year, and it's not always in Iowa. It was this last year. Some years it can be as far away as like Canada, but if you're tuning in, you should just Google that and see if it's somewhat close to you. You can, you don't have to be somebody working in the industry to go. And it's just so enlightening, the information you learn there is just incredible. But one of the presentations I sat in on was how back in, I think it was 2015 or 2016, General Mills, I think, don't they make Cheerios? I think it's General Mills.
Yeah.
They did this big thing with their Honey Nut Cheerio boxes.
Oh.
And it was a push for, we're going to save the bees, of course, because Honey Nut Cheerios. Mm-hmm. And they had their branding. They had the Cheerio box with like the outline of the Honey Nut Cheerio bee, but he was like missing, you know, and they're like, you know, collect five box tops or, and send them in and we'll send you a pollinator mix. And the guy presenting was talking about how we have to make sure that we're getting quality seed. And he went through the seed tag on what these, you know, free seed packets were, and like a bunch of them were non-native
species. To North America.
Right. Right.
Native to like Eurasia or something.
Right. And he was just illustrating, you know, really cheap seed or free seed is, you really need to verify where it's coming from, because, you know, there's a reason why quality seed is going to be, have a little bit higher price tag is because of everything you talked about there, Jake, with how much effort goes into producing that seed. And
I want to jump on.
Yeah.
What Ken was saying, because, some people, for instance, our logo is a pheasant, and pheasants aren't native. And there is an argument to be made. It's not that bad to introduce non-native things. The problem is, you know, whether the math is a quarter of species from Eurasia or 70% or whatever, some percent of them are highly invasive, right? And so we're not trying to gamble on which ones are highly invasive. And so that's a big part of it. You see on Amazon, I mean, the most sold mixes on Amazon, I was looking at this the other day, was their Midwest wildflower mixes. That does not mean they're from the Midwest. That means they can grow in the Midwest. And so they can get these really cheap species from Eurasia. And so that's one, you might not know where your seed's coming from in that way. But another thing is where your seed comes from, ecotype actually matters. For instance, we had told you right before this, we'd sold some seed to Ohio. I didn't sell that gentleman our seed. I emailed another seed company and said, hey, how many species in this mix can you get as closely sourced to Ohio as you can? And they gave a list, and some came from Iowa, some came from Pennsylvania, some came from Ohio. But the point was, we got as many of those species from there as possible, because pale purple coneflower that grows in southern Missouri versus northern Minnesota, very different lifespans. They actually vary in color. A lot of the species will vary in color based on how their latitude, which might not seem like the end of the world, but the color has evolved to match the bee subspecies and the pollinator subspecies. So those are important. I was reading, were we talking about this at a coffee time, Kent?
Yeah, I think you were talking about butterflies choosing flowers based on their color. I think this was a while ago.
I can't remember, but it was either a USDA or a Xerxes Society, and that's just one of many important things about pollinators and where you're gonna source your seed. So if you're looking for it online, there are tons of good places to get it online. But look at their website, see what they're about. Are they talking about trying to get things on the ground? Are they only talking about beauty? That's a red flag to me. Hey, make your yard so beautiful, blah, blah, blah. Well, it's probably filled with annuals that are going to either die out or take over. And so I would just say, look into the website or look into the company that's selling the mix. And if you can see there's some good heart behind it, usually there is, because there's not tons and tons of money in conservation work. So usually if people are doing it, they're doing it for good motivation.
Yeah, for sure. I was just thinking too, it's like a lot of native plants, I would almost say they're more dull than an exotic. And I picture, like, you can think of different types of branding. So anyone listening, like a neon bright color is probably exotic. Yep. And then, like, the nice earth tone branding of a different company is more native. So, like, that's a scout. Yeah. Maybe that's wrong, but that was how my brain thought of it.
Yeah, I mean, all the time, you know, we hear people like, yeah, I mean, I like your wildflower mix, but so many of those, they look like weeds. And what they mean is they don't get bright and purple or bright and yellow. They stay green.
They're very stemmy. You know what I mean? Like they're very stemmy and leafy. But there are a few too that are, you know, like our sweet black-eyed Susan field when it's prime.
Oh yeah.
Carol uses the best word to describe it. He calls it loud. You know, you go to that field and it's just boom, you know. And our rough blazing star field when that's prime, which would be a good time to advertise our Prairie Appreciation Day. We had that last year for the first time in a few years, and it was just a great time. And you can come out and see that rough blazing star field when it's nice and loud.
It's a cool time. I mean, you couldn't imagine seeing so many butterflies that aren't trapped in a building, you know, in one place. There, it's incredible.
Yeah, that field just vibrates. Yeah,
yeah,
that's really cool. And so, what about? I know a lot of people are always thinking about warm season grasses, and so in terms of like checking a tag for warm season grasses, I know obviously they're planted. Alberta, Kansas, and everywhere else. Do you think there's benefits for someone that's in Illinois or Iowa or something like that, finds, you know, blue stem or switchgrass or Indian grass that was grown in Iowa versus in Alberta?
Yeah, I mean, anytime you can get close to your the closer you can get to your ecotype, the better. But also, supply and demand still applies, right? We once interviewed James Holes, one of the founders of Iowa Cover Crop, and he was talking about how if we could have, you know, if we could meet our goal in restoring, you know, get enough people on board to restore as much prairie as possible on you know, in North America, in the Midwest of North America. He's like, that'd be great if you had that many people who wanted to buy that seed, but there isn't that supply to match that kind of demand. You know, that's still, prairie reconstruction is still a new enough concept that, yeah, it's come a long, long way since when the first guys like John Ozenbaugh and Carl Kurtz and Carol, our boss, and Dan Allen, you know, some of those guys that were the first ones to really be doing it. Yeah, there was like nothing around, you know, they were selling out immediately pretty much. But now there's definitely much more of a supply, but even still, you know, every CRP season, you know, there's companies that producers, they got to call around to each other and be like, hey, you guys got any, you know, and, and so it's not the end of the world if somebody has to, you know, source some little blue stem from Minnesota or has to, and they're in central Illinois, you know, that's better than nothing for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right, Jake, in what you're, you know, kind of implying there with, is it best to try and get, you know, is it better to get, if you're in central Illinois, is it better to get your little blue stem from central Iowa than it is from, you know, we'll say Arkansas or from, you know, up in Canada or northern Minnesota? Absolutely. But not the end of the world if that's not possible.
I want to, there's one state that I'm aware of, there might be others, but we mostly service Iowa, any state that touches Iowa, and then like North Dakota and Indiana. Those are like kind of the states that we sell. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And of all those states, there's only one that requires yellow tag or certified sourced seed. So from a specific area, and it's Missouri. And Missouri, it can be sourced anywhere in Missouri, and then specific counties touching Missouri, something like that. And it's kind of complicated, but there's definitely pros. They get local source seed. There are cons though. A big con is that there's not enough growers in Missouri, so they rely more on outside, but their mixes are a lot less diverse because they can't find some seed. Yeah. So I mean, if someone really wants Ohio spiderwort in their mix and they can only get it from Ohio, I would say it's better to go to Ohio and get that Ohio spiderwort, or common spiderwort, some people call it, and plant it in Iowa than to not have any in Iowa. I think there's probably people out there that would argue against me on that. But, you know, I've been to those fields where I know like common yarrow is only on the western part of the state. And I've seen it in fields in our area where it's not even technically as native. And bees and butterflies and pollinators and pheasants are still hanging out in that field. So I think you're getting a lot of benefit, even though it's not specifically. But like Kent said, when you can go local, stay as local as you can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and some of that, if somebody's like truly a purist in their reconstruction, you can ask the producer too and be like, hey, where is this seed sourced from? Because going along with the supply problem, you know, some species, they're just so, you know, we're still in the early days of cultivating them, you know, and getting them back, you know, at an availability at a large scale. You know, you might have a genotype that comes from central Illinois, but is being grown on our farm in central Iowa. You know, we have some species like that, like our white wild indigo, for instance, is a Illinois genotype that we grow on a farm. So then we can't, you know, yellow tag that species, but you know, there's ways if you need to match, you know, an ecotype for your state, it could be grown in another state, but you know, is from that ecotype. And that also confirms, you know, those are kind of, I think the right science term is a labile niche for, you know, it can flex a little bit for where it, you know, does well.
Is there row crop conventional farming? There's a bunch of subsidies and like the USDA and Farm Bill really steps in and helps farmers. And I'm not a row crop farmer. So, but is there any support for guys like you planting prairie? Much. Like, is there price loss coverage in case Switchgrass Market, you know, tanks there, or what?
Well, that's funny that you mentioned that. There technically is. And yep. Switchgrass was what got us to quit applying for it, because the cost was so high and the payout when you needed it was so poor. Yeah. And that it was a switchgrass field that caught, this was before both Nicholas and my time, I think, at Hoxie. Yeah. Carroll had a switchgrass field destroyed by hail, I believe. And he had to file a claim, and it didn't amount to what. By the time he had filled out all the paperwork and gone through all the headaches and the, you know, minimal amount that he received
on by all all conservative accounts, what should have been a $15,000 check, I think they offered like $3,100 because they don't have a standard price like they do corn. Right. Oh, you missed out on this much money. Yeah. We'll give you 70% of that or something. They said, well, this is the lowest price we could find for switchgrass. I'm like, yeah, but that switchgrass is in like Montana. That's totally different switchgrass, you know?
Right.
Yeah. And so dad was like, nope, not doing that. But in terms of subsidies, not really. There is, for the farmer who buys our seed, they get paid half of the price back. That does not mean we get a double the price. It just means that the farmer then gets help putting prairie down, which I think is good. Yeah.
Yeah, that is good. Yeah. Cost sharing.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Which is something that you guys sell a lot of. So I know on your guys' website, you have CRP blends, and we've been working together on getting some Equip blends for my house. Yeah. And so for someone that's looking to buy, I mean, I know there's a few different locations for someone that maybe is getting ready to maybe sign up for CRP, or maybe when the Farm Bill comes around officially, we'll get some more enrollment. Oh, but just talk a little bit about your guys' CRP blends and how you can just go on there and look at the specific program and what people should know.
Oh man, I take deep pride in our CRP blend. So
yeah,
CRP,
can I brag on Nick here real quick?
Oh man,
then I'm going to let Nick explain this because he's the guru on this. But Nick designs our. Every year he has a goal of adding, you know, a couple species to our CRP mixes, which might not sound like that big of a deal because it's like, well, yeah, you just charge more then, right? And the answer is, not really, maybe kind of, definitely not as significant as one would expect. Nick basically just tries to make the mix work so that it can be just as competitive as always with price, but with more diversity each year. So he carefully looks through each and every species he's going to be putting into that mix each year. He redesigns our mixes to make sure that he can fit in the most diversity possible, because he understands that as wonderful of I've heard people call it this, and I would agree with them, that CRP is the greatest conservation thing that has been accomplished in like the last 50 years in our country, probably since Teddy Roosevelt was doing all of his national park and national forest and refuges that he set up. CRP is probably our biggest victory thing, but it's still, you know, as I was saying earlier, prairies are hundreds of species and CRP are maybe dozens of species for the most diverse mixes. And Nick understands that. And so his way of trying to help fix that problem within the solution is to try and add as much diversity. And so he even makes it so that the lower quality CRP mixes, you know, the cheaper mixes, right, that a lot of people are getting because they don't necessarily care how diverse the mix is. They just know that they got to meet a requirement, and he puts way more species in than needed to qualify because he wants that species to do well. So from there, I'll let Nick explain how setting up the mixes works and
well, all that. It's a whole process. So in terms of CRP in the Midwest, there's like, let me think, three, maybe five behemoths that set the price. And there's one organization that stands above them all. And so I go to that organization and I see, okay, your price is $142 for a CB25. My goal is to be $2 to $5 cheaper per acre and then sell and then put as much. So this year, our CB25 is $135 at like set price. If you have like 100 acres, obviously the price would go down. But I say, okay, for $135, how many species can I put in? And not lose the farm, you know, and that's my challenge every year. I think this year I had 38 forbs and 12 grasses or something. I was either really close or I hit 50 species, and that's the goal. I we're not there yet as an industry, but I'd love to be at 75. That's kind of my 5-year goal. I want to be able to hit 75 species per mix, and then the lower end, the higher end would be CP42. And here's the trick though. My CP25 or our CP25 qualifies as a CP42, which means a pollinator. So our normal prairie qualifies as a pollinator. The reason being our diversity is so high in it. Though the lower quality one would be a CP2. And the reason I don't dump tons and tons of forbs, I still try and hit 15 to 20 forbs. I think the requirement's 3. The reason I don't dump tons and tons is that one's more of a tall grass habitat. A wildlife habitat that they specify for pheasants or for whitetail, the edges. So that's kind of that's our goal. This I heard a stat. I don't know how true this is. This is from a salesman of a different seed company that they thought like 82% of all native seed moved through CRP. And I don't know if you include equip on that as well, but in terms of prairie industry, it is propped by CRP. And that's something that I think is beautiful and amazing. And I cannot stand. I do not like an industry being propped up by the government, because then if the farm bill is down for 5 straight years, you know, hold on tight. You might not have anything. Yeah. And I don't like that. It doesn't sit well with me. So actually a goal of mine separate from CRP is Kent and I have looked around. We've spent years doing this at this point. What cracks can we get prairie into? Anything. Where it makes sense, not forcing it in there, not making it inconvenient for people, but really what. And so my brother-in-law came up with backyard pollinator, you know, getting some backyard mixes and designed some mixes with that. And Kent and I have, I mean, we'll probably talk about this more, but like perennial food plots and stuff like that. So CRP is the behemoth when it comes to getting natives on the ground. And I take a lot of pride in making sure that our CRP is really high quality instead of just, oh, let's throw down big blue stem and get our check. No, let's see some pheasants and some quail and some whitetail. And maybe even maybe if you have a good short grass mix, you might get some jackrabbits in there. You know, that's kind of our goal is really to buff it up as much as we can. So,
Well, it's funny where a lot of people are like, well, you know, why would I care to have all these different things? But if you can't listen to a single habitat podcast without someone saying the words diversity. So you guys are maximizing the amount of diversity, period. And and also be cost competitive too. So I think that is really cool. And obviously shows the level of passion that you guys have for this and trying to go above and beyond and also remain ultra competitive too. And I planted some of my CRP last year. I'm like, dang it. I wish I would have ran across you guys before, because I would have much rather preferred to buy it from you guys. So,
appreciate
it. But that's really good. And I think right now is, it's kind of like the brunt of habitat season for whitetail hunters, myself included. Every spare second I'm trying to go out and work, and something that, I just kind of want to harp on warm season grasses, because I think to your point, you mentioned your dad's failures. And I think there's a lot of failures and a lot of delayed gratification when it comes to warm season grasses. And ultimately across the board, we as humans don't have a lot of patience. And it seems like it takes patience for this type of thing. So I want to run through a scenario where someone, they didn't prep last fall. Right. And let's say it's kind of brome grass or cool season grasses, and they're sitting here on March 21st. Or let's say even April 1st, and they're thinking, is there anything that I can do? And I want to hear what's the best course of action? And this person is adamant. They're not going to say, I'm not going to wait another year because I'm not going to do it. So is it even possible to try to establish some warm season grasses as of April 1?
So when you're saying they're adamant, they're not going to wait another year. They don't want to frost seed in this coming December is what correct. You're saying. They want to plant.
You can say they should do that, but they don't want to. Yeah, I don't want to do it.
I have that conversation almost every day.
That conversation a lot. They really should. They really should wait until December and get a second killing. But if not, something that I'm curious about, and maybe if somebody has tried this, they could reach out to Jake, and Jake could connect you to me because I'd love to talk to you about it. But So brome and cool season invasive grasses, they are the bane of prairie, right? They take it over, they turn it into a really sloppy looking, unhealthy prairie. And a lot of times people think, well, I'll just go ahead and burn that and burn all that brome grass off. And
it literally like means you're talking about me right now.
Yeah, that helps. Like if you do it at the right time though, because a lot of people right now, you know, they're burning. And the only people that should be burning right now are people that do not have a brome problem in their prairie or somebody who really wants to have a lot of brome come June. Those are the only two people that should be burning right now. Everyone else should be waiting until like mid-April or later, like in the like early May.
We burned May 14th last year.
Wow. Right. Now this year we'll burn earlier than that because it's been such an early spring. But like really nobody should be burning if they have a brome problem. Nobody should be burning before April. That being said, the reason you shouldn't be burning now is because those plants are not vulnerable yet. They are vulnerable when they've all emerged out of the ground. They're just now starting to emerge out of the ground, but most of them, or probably at least half of those plants, are still dormant, right? And so if you wait till April, now all those cool season grasses are up and you burn then, now you really hurt those plants and you set them back. But also, you know, by mid-April or early May, all the warm season grasses are finally starting to catch up and they're starting to wake up and they're starting to green up. And so you're setting the table for them by burning at that time. So I know we're talking about getting ready to plant, and I'm getting there, but I need to explain the burning side of this. So, and where I think I have a theory that maybe could help somebody plant earlier. So the advantage is yes, clearing off old thatch, taking care of those cool season pressures, but it's also blackening the earth, causing that darker color of the earth to absorb more sunlight and warm, you know, very locally warm those soil temperatures to help spur on the growth of those warm season grasses. So here's my theory, Jake. If somebody were to maybe in, we'll say April this year, early April, go in, all their cool season brome is up, it's green, and they got warm enough overnight temps to go ahead and hit it with a herbicide and kill off, get your first killing of all that,
this is when it's green. So like a glyphosate 2,4-D.
Right. Right. If you could do that and then, you know, you kill it off, everything's dead, goes back to brown, you know, you've killed your existing cool season grasses there. Then if you went and burned all that thatch and
like 2 weeks later, you're saying,
yeah. Or, you know, as soon as everything's dead, go ahead and burn all that thatch. Of course you need the seed bank to germinate. So maybe you'd have to have a rain in there, but those soil temps should be pretty well nice and warm to like maybe set the table for another flush of growth off that seed, off that invasive seed bank. And maybe you could do another, you know, in May when those cool seasons, you could maybe be green again and that seed bank could have germinated. And maybe you could get a double killing then and then plant in June. That would be my only thing, my only thought. And this is just totally a theory. Best practice by far is to get the killing of that existing cool season grass once in the spring and then again in the late summer, early fall, when we get that time of year rains that come in and give us that second flush of green growth, almost, you know, kind of like that idea of getting that second cutting of a hay field. If you do your second spraying, then that's the best. So what is most likely to happen if you just do a single application is you're going to be fighting brome again down the road, you know, because there's a seed bank that exists there from those years of brome or Kentucky blue or fescue or orchard grass, whatever is there. Reed canary is the ultimate worst. There's going to be a seed bank there ready to take the place of everything that you just sprayed off. And so that's why you need to get that double kill. But if you only get a single kill, I would say probably your best bet would be, and Nick, you can chime in here, but I think planting some species that are going to come up quickly, because that's the problem with restoring ground to prairie, is it takes a couple years for those warm season species. They're setting a root so quickly that they're not focusing on that above ground cover, which allows room for those cool season grasses to regain a foothold. And so if you could plant like some Virginia wild rye, some black-eyed Susan, there are some native annuals. I am not well versed in native annuals, but I know there's some research
out there. Paul Bellflower, Partridge Pea. I guess Partridge Pea is technically a biannual.
Yeah, but that would be a good one though, Nick, to throw in there. But maybe do some research on some of those to mix in on, like, you know, almost like view it as a front end of your mix. Like, these are the species I'm going to have in the first couple years, but then also have those. Definitely have big blue stem, I would say, because big blue stem is probably the most aggressive warm season grass. It's my favorite grass for multiple reasons. I love the turkey claw on it, but also it just, like, it anchors the prairie. You know what I mean? Like, it's, you're not pushing big blue stem out of the way. And so that can kind of help fight off those cool season grasses as well. So that would be my advice for, and switchgrass, make sure you got switch in there. Switch does a pretty good job holding its own, and little blue as well. You know, really try and get some of that. If you can't get a double kill, cause they're all usually the only reason is cause you're too impatient. then do that. Maybe a good compromise though, Jake, that I'd throw in there, and I've suggested this to people, is I know you don't want there to be nothing there. You want, especially if you're looking at hunting value, you that's why people are impatient for it, right? They, because most
this
people
season, this season only,
right? Well, and you've talked about this with your efforts in removing bush honeysuckle off of your property. It's like, that's like the only cover I have right now. You know, it's like, I don't want to get rid of it because now I have nothing. And so that's like, you know, I'm a deer hunting is a passion of mine as well. And I understand that mindset. So maybe a good middle ground is to cover crop in between those two killings. So get your spring application done, kill off everything that's there. Then go ahead and maybe seed in like oats in the middle there, you know, a nice annual crop. Oats are never going to dominate your prairie. And even if you wanted to, you could, I mean, now you lose your habitat value come and forage value come hunting season. You could mow them off though, if you're concerned about them reseeding themselves. But I would just, for a hunting property, I just let the oats grow and go to head, and they can be another food source for the deer come, you know, almost like a food plot come hunting season. And then when the timing's right in the fall, you can, you know, get that other application down and seed in December, which would be really the best way to do it.
What if, and this is 100% me asking right now. So some areas where you could burn it off, and could you hypothetically hit it with a simazine for a long-term residual and then seed it in later?
Is that a 6 week or a 4 week?
I read somewhere 60 days, which felt really long.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I was just talking to a guy about some of this last week. I'm not super familiar with it, but I know that it does leave a residual. And as long as you know that you're well beyond that window for when you're going to be doing your seeding, and when you're hoping your seeding to come up is going to come up, then yeah, you could you could definitely, you know, play around with stuff like that. Just to, I assume what you're saying is you don't want, because someone's not going to want to enter their property with equipment like in late August or early September, they don't want to be pushing deer around. Or
it's the impatience factor is what it is. Yeah. 100%. Yeah. Well, there's a gazillion different videos on YouTube, which I think is why it's really confusing for a lot of people until they figure out their own method. And then once they figure out what works, they're just going to stick with that, what that is. But I mean, there's a school of thought of even, I frost seeded, some switchgrass this year. Mm-hmm. And that the suggestion is to hit it with atrazine or simazine, like right now or early April to kill anything that would come up. And then at, you know, however many weeks later, the switchgrass is starting to germinate. That's the strategy from what I understand. And
our friend Skip Sly would argue with that. I think he gets his switchgrass to show up the first year pretty well.
Well, he's got to figure it out. He's got a few decades of experience.
Yeah, he knows what he's doing, dude.
Yeah, Skip's got probably more practical experience with using natives and whitetail habitat management strategies. You know, he's got it down. But yeah, I think, you know, I can see where that could maybe help. The only problem I would have with that is, and maybe if my, you know, like what I was, you know, hypothesizing with burning it and trying to get the soil temps up high enough to maybe it, while we still have some moisture, get the seed bank to germinate those invasives. You know, we really don't see that second green up of those cool seasons until after, you know, the hottest time of the year, hottest, driest time of the year. And so I don't know that having that residual sitting in the soil is going to be doing what you think it's going to be doing. You know what I mean?
Like, you know, it's what not- worked for me for my yard. So you're talking about Kentucky Blue, like a sun and shade mix is what it was. But, not planting it, but eliminating that mix out of it is I sprayed it and like maybe right about now, end of March, maybe first of April, has been a few years now. Then I rototilled it. Then I packed it down and it was still early enough. So I sprayed it and I think I left it for a week, let it die. And then I tilled it up, I packed it down and then it tried to come back and then I sprayed it again and then it didn't. And then I planted that spring and it worked pretty well. But I understand like getting a good tilling and then packing it down. That's a lot more steps and a lot more work,
More equipment. But yeah, I mean, you can't experience, you know, like that's the, like there's always the chemical and the mechanical removal of weeds. Mm-hmm. Right. And then in mechanical, you know, some of those old tried and true methods of, you know, a rotary hoe or a field cultivator or something like that, you know, you can do some experimenting with that too. The other thing too, go ahead, Nick.
I was just gonna say, it's worth noting that it rained a lot after I tilled it up and packed it back down, so there was incentive and there was a lot of moisture for those cool season grasses to come back.
Ken's been saying this thing recently.
He said, you know, like how water will run down the hill back when it rained, like back then.
In the old days, yeah.
No rain.
Dust Bowl.
Right.
You know, another thing too is, what was I going to say? I lost it. Come back to me. I'm getting old. It was a really good tip.
So good that it's you have to get through this paywall now.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. It had to do with mechanical weed removal. But
you heard him, Ken. If you pay me $20, you will remember.
I'm sorry, guys. It'll come back to me at 2 a.m. when I can't sleep because I'm old.
Yeah. One strategy that I've noticed the most on YouTube is like the simazine and then hitting it with if it does green up, hit it with glyphosate 2,4-D again, and then possibly again, and then planting at the end of that. So that'd be similar to the multiple sprains. But I know a lot of people don't want to mess with chemicals that much too. So the tried and true method seems to be prep for a year and then frost seed it. And after you frost seed it, is there anything that they need to do that following spring? If it's bare dirt.
So actually it goes well with, I remembered what I was going to say and it wasn't mechanical. It was chemical removal, spot treating. So if somebody was really impatient, that is one thing they could do is just invest in a backpack sprayer, and just kind of go around and see, okay, yep, I can definitely tell this is brome coming up here again, or reed canary, and just spray those specific areas, and just do it early enough to where, and that is the advantage. If there is an advantage to taking care of cool season plants, it's that they're greening up before the natives are. So you're not gonna, you know, if you get in there like early April, you're not going to be hurting your native seeding. Most likely there are a few cool season, like prairie June grass. This is an early green up, and SOG kind of seems to like to come along a little bit earlier as well, which is Cytotrichoma. And so you got to be kind of careful there. If you know that you have those in your seeding, maybe be a little more careful, but if not, then you can kind of go in there and spot treat as needed.
Mm-hmm. No.
And so coming out of your frost seeding, really you need to just be patient for a while and see what's coming up. And from there, it's a mowing regimen for the first couple years. I think Nick usually used the rule of shin high, right?
Knee high
is when
mow knee high.
Well, no, mm-hmm. When it gets knee high, hit it to your ankles.
Okay,
that's right. That's your little trick.
I can remember that one.
The shin was just the average, you know,
yeah.
Between ankle and knee.
Well, and I think there's one benefit to this too. Is obviously it takes longer to establish, but if you have a good native stand of warm season grasses, man, it's an expensive seed, right? And I think that a lot of people fall into the trap of, well, I'll just buy this annual screen that gets knocked over in November after it gets windy, where that's, you know, right. Like, warm season grasses seem to hold up a little bit longer. So I mean, I think that's the one thing that I've noticed, because I've tried the annual screens, and I don't want to use any of them really because of those specific reasons. So it takes longer to establish, but lasts for a very, very, very long time if it's well maintained, which is a huge benefit, cost benefit actually down the road too.
Right. Well, yeah.
Let me just make a plea to all of your listeners. Please do not plant miscanthus or pampas grass. And I'm sorry. I mean, you might have had someone on here saying that it is pretty effective. Kent and I fight the side effects of it all the time. I mean, and I've seen it where ditches for miles are covered in pampas or miscanthus. I mean, miles. And so they say it doesn't spread. It doesn't spread by seed. That is correct. But it is rhizomous. And it basically just pops a plant up next to it every year. And so there's really good switchgrass alternatives. So,
yeah, switchgrass has become almost an industry inside of an industry, you know, all the different varieties.
Oh my gosh. I have conversations with the people all the time where, you know, it used to just be switchgrass, and now it has to be this specific variety and this thing because it, you know, so yeah, you're right. And I think that's really interesting. And there are a lot of options, and that's probably one of the most common questions I get. Just with clients is like, well, what do you think about miscanthus? And it's like, there's some experts or people that are really passionate about this space that are huge proponents. Right. And my opinion has been formed from asking biologists, and you know, they're not huge fans of it, along with you guys too. But that's probably could be a whole podcast in itself.
Right. So, right.
So yeah. we'll close the door on that one. But. There you guys have it. Come see me Saturday in Rock Island County at Stone's Apple Barn for the auction open house, if you want to call it that, from 1 to 5. Hope to see you guys there. Give me a call if you're interested. This, like I said, I do not share many parcels on what I have going on in my real estate business, but this one is simply too good to not share for everyone that is looking for an exceptional and rare piece. Bid on this fourth generation farm April 10th at 1 o'clock. Hope you guys have a great week. Until next time, see you.